1st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
On Monday, February 15th, at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kboppc@gmail.com and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, P.C., Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Gray wolves were once common in Oregon, occupying most of the state. But as soon as Euro-Americans started settling in Oregon, they set out to wipe out the wolves. This campaign finally succeeded in extirpating the last Oregon wolf in 1947. 60 years later, wolves are making a comeback in the state, and there are now 81 wolves roaming eastern and southern Oregon. But for wolf advocates, that number is a good start, but hardly an ultimate goal. While many ranchers in eastern Oregon still feel that any wolf is a wolf too many. Recently, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission delisted wolves as an endangered species. This morning, we talked with Rob Clavins, Northeast Oregon field organizer for Oregon Wild, and Stephanie Taylor, Oregon Wild Wolf organizer, about Oregon wolves' long road to recovery and what Oregon residents can do to increase, not reduce, protections for our wolf population. Rob and Stephanie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, let's start by talking about this recent decision by the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to delist the wolves. What does that mean to the 81 wolves that are roaming the state?
Well, and we hope there are more than 81 wolves in the state. We know we have a population of at least 81, and that's a good start. It wasn't that long ago we didn't have any wolves in the state. And usually when a wildlife agency says that a species has recovered, that's something that we'd like to celebrate. It's something we celebrated when gray whales were taken off the Endangered Species Act list or bald eagles. But that's because we didn't have a campaign of misinformation and fear about those animals. And the reality is, even if we're on the right track and 81 wolves is 81 more than we had a few years ago, it's still a long way from recovered. And I think that's really, if you're an optimist, you can definitely look to that and say, boy, we've come a long way from when we had bounties for wolves in the state of Oregon to a place now where we're talking about how we can protect them and we have a population back in the state. But it's also a long way from happily ever after. And so the decision by the state to delist wolves, to strip them of endangered species protection, is very troubling for people who value native wildlife. wolves only occupy 12% of the habitat in the state that has been identified by scientists still in the 21st century as being good habitat. So certainly we're at a place where we can take stock and celebrate the fact that we've come a long way. But the decision that the agency made over the input of scientists, of the general public, really was troubling and seemed driven far more by politics than science or Oregon conservation values.
So what are the reasons, do you think? What kind of pressures were put to bear on the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to make that decision?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of wildlife agencies see wolves as a headache. They are controversial for some people, whereas there's not nearly as much controversy about elk and meadowlarks and all of the other animals that they're in charge of managing. But the agency has a mission to protect and restore and conserve wildlife for all Oregonians. And so it's those animals that make life difficult because they present us with challenges, as wolves and other native carnivores do, are often treated differently. And I think that's what was so frustrating about this decision. If there were only 80 elk in the state of Oregon, we wouldn't be talking about how we can reduce protections for them. We would be talking about an emergency and how do we solve this crisis. We need elk back on the landscape. But there's also a lot of long-held fears of wolves and any animal with pointy teeth. We tried to eliminate them from the landscape. It was actually part of the founding of the state of Oregon. The first meeting that created the state was in part to address the problem of marauding wolves. And that was something that actually unified the settlers and allowed them to create the state of Oregon.
I'm thinking today, and I want to wish everybody a happy Martin Luther King Day. I guess Oregon was founded on eliminating or keeping out two populations, wolves and black people, because that's another thing that and I don't know, there's probably not much of a relationship, but maybe there is about misunderstanding, and also this design by Euro-American descendants that we can keep everything for ourselves.
Yeah,
and we want to keep the others out.
Well, and there's definitely, and we could, again, you can look back and say, look at how far we've come, and you can also say, look at how far we haven't come. And to that question of what really influenced this is there is a vocal minority of people who are still fearful of wolves. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation about wolves. And then there's, quite frankly, there are interests that benefit from that. If you want to see public lands opened up and you see any sort of conservation rules about what wildlife you can and can't shoot, where you can or can't drill for oil, being able to delist wolves from the Endangered Species Act, whether it be federal or state, is something that, if you see those protections as getting in the way of progress, getting rid of those protections is a positive. And I think they play on a lot of the fears that people do have of the big bad wolf. And there are legitimate concerns. Wolves can present challenges, but at the end of the day, they're a native species. They have a right to be on the landscape. And there are a lot of different solutions that don't require picking up the gun or shooting them. And so we've got a lot to learn yet. But yeah, looking back at history, in some ways we can say, boy, we've come a long way. And in other ways, it doesn't feel that way all the time.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's probably true in the case of any element of nature or of human nature and human society that we decide that is too scary. I guess it's because it's Martin Luther King Day today. I keep thinking about this, that I think that our inability to really understand or empathize with wolves and understand what an important part of the ecosystem they play is in some ways analogous to racism and to our the white majority in this country's inability to accept people of color, whether it's Africans that were brought here as slaves, whether it's immigrants from South America, and now immigrants from the Middle East, that there's this protectionism that people who stole this land from people who lived here before then start to have and in protecting themselves, miss the big picture of what diversity is about and of what the importance that every living being has on this planet. So I want to go back to sort of take the story of wolves backwards in Oregon. And I want to go back to when the wolves were first introduced into Idaho. And it was a pretty successful program. And the wolves started spilling over into Oregon. And I think that response that Oregon had is very illustrative of Oregon's complicated and conflicted history with wolves and anybody else of diversity.
Yeah, well, I think you're right that old prejudices do die hard in many different ways. And you know, we certainly had this idea when the West was settled that the horizon was limitless, and you know, there were plenty of bison to shoot once upon a time, and you know, any animal again with pointy teeth was a threat to our way of life, and we ought to eliminate from the landscape. But over time, I think we came to understand that that the horizon is not limitless, and that we don't want to make species go extinct on purpose. That they may have value, whether we understand that value or not. And we codified that with the Endangered Species Act. We said we were no longer going to allow wildlife to go extinct. And so wolves were exterminated from the state of Oregon in 1947. That was the last wolf bounty. There may have been some wolves after that time here and there in the state, but for all intents and purposes, that's when they were gone. And that wolf was a wolf that was killed near the Rogue-Umpqua Divide near Crater Lake National Park, or what is now Crater Lake National Park. Wolves started to make their way back on their own into northwestern Montana, but it was, in 1995 and 1996 that the process was sped up when wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park and into central Idaho. And it didn't take long for the first wolf to find its way into Oregon, cross the Snake River. But unfortunately, its story was that everybody, of course, or not everybody, but some people freaked out that there was a wolf back in Oregon, and you know, it's the end of the world, the sky is falling. So the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife darted the wolf, put the wolf in a crate, put the crate in a helicopter, and shipped it back to Idaho. So that's how wolf recovery in Oregon got started.
I like that this wolf is illegal. This wolf is trespassing in Oregon. And the story sort of got told that way. I think it was, and the way it was told, depending the way it was told, really was a reflection on these different attitudes. So there were people in the environmental community who were really excited about the reintroduction of wolves into Idaho and Yellowstone, who thought it was absurdly... It was funny if it weren't. It was absurdly funny if it weren't so sad that this wolf was actually carted back to Idaho. But there were the people, particularly ranchers in eastern Oregon, who were just so horrified by the thought that a wolf would actually cross the Snake River and cross this border. And what right do you have to cross this border?
Well, wolves have, if nothing else, they surprise us. And actually, another good story that really sort of shows the different attitudes is the story of OR7, which a lot of folks know about, the wolf better known as Journey. And that was a wolf that that started out in northeastern Oregon in Wallowa County, where I live, to the Amnaha pack, and crossed, went thousands and thousands of miles, found his way into California, where he was celebrated as a celebrity, and the story went worldwide. And it was just this great conservation success story that everybody was thrilled about, this wolf defying the odds. And even people who don't love wolves couldn't help but sort of begrudgingly respect this wolf for what it had done. Unfortunately, his litter mate from the very same litter crossed the Snake River, went back to Idaho, and was killed illegally. And showing the attitude there, the hunter who illegally killed the wolf was given a written warning. And here in Oregon, you know, I think you can kind of see in the middle ground where we're doing some things right, and we're also doing some things that are troubling. And we are at this point when it comes to wolf recovery of, are we going to double down on the success that we've had, or and learn from the past mistakes, or are we going to repeat those past mistakes?
Well, there seems to be a big divide in Oregon's attitudes towards wolves, depending on where you live. At least that's the story that we're being told.
And I think that's true. Having lived in Portland and Bend, and now living in northeastern Oregon, which is a place that is what you think of with Eastern Oregon culturally. But there's a surprising amount of acceptance. You might get the impression that everybody that wears a cowboy hat hates, or drives a pickup truck, hates wolves, or hates wilderness. And that's not true. There certainly are some people who have very strong attitudes, and those are the people who generally speak out. You don't hear people get the bullhorn and say, we want moderation. But even in Wallowa County, which is ground zero in Oregon for the wolf wars, where I live, they've done polling, and the polling is remarkable, that the vast majority of people have moderate positions on wolves. There's a minority who want to kill them all, and there's a minority who never want to see a wolf shot again. But most of the people have pretty middle ground attitudes. You know, they value wildlife. They live out there because it is a big wild place. And I think people, so it's easy to paint with a broad brush that these out of touch liberals in Portland love wolves and just don't get it. And these down to earth Eastern Oregonians hate wolves. And it's more complicated than that.
Well, I was reading, read a couple books about wolves a few years ago, and I wish I should have brought the name of this author who wrote a book about wolves in the Northwest, which is a really excellent book. And he's comparing the wolf packs in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia. And it seemed like the ones in Oregon, and the book's a few years old, and there were probably only a handful of wolves in Oregon. I think there were about three wolf packs at that time. And it was Journey, I think, had just started his journey at that time. So he's describing the issues in eastern Oregon, and it's his sense was that wolves are having a much harder time in Oregon because there's much more ranching that goes on in Oregon than in any of the other states. Stephanie, is that a case? Do you think that that really is true, or is that another myth?
I think in comparison to Washington and northern Idaho, I think that's definitely the case, yeah.
So what does that mean when there's more ranchers? What kinds of traditions have created this extreme enmity towards wolves?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for others. You know, they certainly, people have differing opinions. I think one of the things, though, is, again, there is tremendous fear and misinformation, and it would be nice if we could agree on the basic set of facts. You know, we can disagree with what to do with those facts. You know, if we want to go have a picnic and I say it's sunny out and you say it's raining out, we're not going to be able to have a good discussion about it. And so there are legitimate concerns about living with wolves, but they often get exaggerated. And that, unfortunately, is part of what feeds the divide. I believe my set of facts, you believe yours. And Fox News tells me this, and MSNBC tells me that. And so there's some disagreement on those basic facts, which is unfortunate. But I think a big part of that cultural piece, and this is me projecting and maybe doing some armchair psychoanalysis, which I shouldn't do, but I'll do it all the same, is that, you know, I think the identity of the rugged individual in the American West is that, you know, if you have a problem, you solve it the way you best see fit. And when it comes to wolves, if you see wolves as a problem, you shoot that wolf. And so the idea that somebody can tell me what I can and cannot shoot, if I believe that in my heart of hearts is what may be causing a problem, that's anathema to me. And so whether or not it really is a threat, the person telling me that I can't do that, that's the threat. And I think that's what we've seen happen a lot. And when it comes to wolves, it's unfortunate because science is showing us that killing wolves, though it's cathartic, it's a simple solution, it often is not the best solution. There's recent science that came out of Washington State University that showed, similar to killing coyotes is one of the best ways to increase the population. Killing cougars is one of the best ways to increase the local population because you lose the territoriality. And likewise with wolves.
Wait, can you explain that? I'm sort of getting it, but not quite. And I'm sure my listeners are kind of going, huh?
And thanks for doing that, because I often just think everybody knows everything about wildlife and thinks about
nothing
else.
So how are you decreasing the territorialism if you kill a wolf or a coyote?
So maybe I'll actually take the cougar example. Cougars are territorial. And so if you have a big male cougar in an area that's not killing livestock and you kill that cougar, it's no longer defending that territory. And so now younger animals are coming in, vying for that territory. So you can actually have a localized increased population. And I've heard some ranchers say that as a solution too, is if you got a pack of coyotes or you have a cougar that's not killing your livestock, leave it alone. And with wolves, the issue is that they're, you know, we often hear we should just treat wolves like other wildlife. And the reality is we're not treating them like other wildlife. And we're not treating them in the same way, I would say in the wrong way. But one of the ways that they're different is they're incredibly socially, they have these complex social interactions. There's a lot of wildlife management that's just informed by raw numbers. What's the population? If you kill 10%, it goes down by 10%, and all the impacts are down by 10%. But with wolves, it's much more complex than that. They have societies, they have complex social structures within their packs. And if you disrupt that social structure, you can create significantly more problems than you had before. And we're now actually seeing that in the data. And really quickly, the Oregon experience has been really interesting. And since 2012, Oregon has been the only state in the nation that has not purposely killed wolves. In that time, not surprisingly, the wolf population has increased. But what surprised a lot of people is that conflict has stayed low and by many measures decreased. You've seen in other states, Idaho, Washington, where killing wolves does not reduce controversy. It doesn't reduce the number of livestock depredations. And we so often talk about this conflict, but the reality is Oregon is home to 1.3 million cows. The last year for which we have statistics, 55,000 died before they made it to the slaughterhouse from weather, disease, domestic dogs, human thieves. Wolves in 2015 killed 4 cows.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Rob Clavins, who's the Northeast Oregon field organizer for Oregon Wild, and Stephanie Taylor, who's the wolf organizer for Oregon Wild. We hope to hear from more from you, Stephanie, while we're sitting here. As you're just saying, Rob, that I had just read an article about how when they removed restrictions, the federal restrictions on wolves as an endangered species, which happened several years ago, and wolves were ranches were allowed again to kill problem wolves, that predation went way down, and also the elk population returned. And I just wonder, and I'm trying to remember, I read this just yesterday, I'm trying to remember where I read this, but I just wondered what's your take on that and who would be putting out information like that?
Yeah, there's certainly some cherry-picked data. I mean, there are places where the elk population has decreased with the return of wolves, and there's places where it's increased. And, you know, we sort of have this idea, again, with wildlife management, which is sort of the ultimate oxymoron, that we can keep things a certain way. Nature always changes. And there are more wildlife units where elk are above objective in the West that wolves have returned than below.
And actually, I mean, this is another thing that hunters don't like to hear, but you really don't want to have too many elk, because I also read this in the wolf book, that when you have you take away the apex predator, the wolf, from a region, then the elk and the deer go wild, and then you start killing all the forests because they're nibbling on all these young trees. So wolves, in fact, are very important in maintaining a healthy elk population, I understand.
That's true, and I think it comes down to what do we want to see our public lands managed for? What do we want to see wildlife managed for? If we want to see our state managed as a game farm, you can never have too many elk. But if we want to see a healthy, intact landscape, you want to have all of the pieces. Aldo Leopold, who's sort of the father of the conservation movement, said the first word in ignorance is he who asks of an animal or plant, what good is it? The key to intelligent tinkering is to keep all of the pieces. And for a long time, we didn't study the role of animals like wolves and cougars and bears. We just simply shot them. And what we've learned is that without wolves, and these other apex predators and other wildlife play critical and irreplaceable roles. And that's been bearing itself out. Scientists from Oregon have demonstrated in Yellowstone National Park, the return of wolves had all sorts of different effects. The elk population there was way high above historic norms. Elk did reduce, the population went down when wolves came back, and they also changed their behavior. So they spent less time browsing on stream sides, and you saw an increase of riparian vegetation, streamside vegetation, that is food for beavers. And now you had beavers, so you had more beaver dams, so you actually had more frogs. There's all sorts of different impacts that wolves had that in their absence, we didn't understand, you know, we didn't understand what their absence meant. And now we're finally understanding with their return what that can mean. But again, I think having some humility, we don't understand the incredible complexity of an ecosystem. It's much more complex than the iPhone in your pocket. And yet we think we can understand these things. And having all of the pieces really means we have a healthier landscape.
Did you want to add something, Stephanie?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that, you know, it's important to think about the fact that wolves have only been back in Oregon for 6 or 7 years, and there have been tremendous studies done in Yellowstone about the effects of wolves on the ecosystem, but there hasn't been enough time to really study the effects of wolves in Oregon, the economic benefits, the social aspects, or the ecological aspects of what wolves could do in Oregon yet.
Well, I'm thinking about changing behavior, because I'm as I hear about ranchers who lose cows and sheep, and I understand that that's really it's really emotionally exhausting, and it's a pretty horrific thing to happen, whether it, you know, it's one cow or many cows. And so as a non-cow owner, but I have a couple cats and a dog, and so I think about, well, okay, what's my analogy here living in Portland close to Oaks Bottom? Well, a couple of years ago, we started keeping our cats inside because of a number of reasons, and it was like predators on both ends. Part of it was we couldn't stand to watch them killing birds, and the other part of it, I didn't want them to get killed by a coyote. And there's So I changed my behavior, changed my cat's behavior. They're pretty happy indoor cats now. I don't worry about the coyotes, and so I feel a little bit less nervous about the increasing number of coyotes that there are in my neighborhood, who I think need a place to live because they've lost a lot of their territory through suburbanization. And I also don't worry about the birds, and so now I can really enjoy the birds, watch them out the kitchen window and not worry about whether the cats are out there to get them. So I wonder if there's ways that ranchers can also change behavior so that their cows were better protected.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, too, that there are legitimate concerns. And it's sort of like being told, you know, if your sister gets hit by lightning, it doesn't make you feel better that she was the only person in the country that got hit by lightning last year. It's kind of a bummer. And, you know, so there are legitimate concerns. We should take those seriously. And again, that's why it's so frustrating when we hear so much misinformation. And very quickly, just touching back on the elk, you know, I think it's worth noting in the thousands of years before Europeans started settling the West, wolves did not make elk go extinct, and they're not going to do that now. They might make them more wary. They might lower their numbers in some places, but they're not going to make them go extinct. We seem to be the only animals capable of that. But going back to your question about sort of our changing behavior, again, wolves can present some real challenges for wildlife managers and for all sorts of different folks. But I think it's important to contextualize, you know, some of those numbers. And there are things that people can do other than pick up the gun. And I think that's the problem is it comes down to control and what is my preferred solution as opposed to what's the best solution. And sort of one of the best examples, Defenders of Wildlife, another conservation organization, worked with officials in Idaho in the Wood River Valley in a place that should be ground zero for the worst potential situation, the way that the landscape is, the operations there. And they did all sorts of different non-lethal measures to reduce the conflict, to prevent the conflict from happening. And it's incredible how successful it's been. It's been cost-effective. It requires people doing things differently. And I think just one of the examples here in Oregon, one of the simplest things folks can do is clean up carcass pits. You know, dealing with wolves, and I'm sympathetic, dealing with wolves prior to 1947 was really easy. You shot it, you poisoned it, you trapped it, you killed it. After 1947, it was even easier. There were no wolves. And now we have this animal back on the landscape, and we're saying, is there room in the West for wildlife like wolves and humans? And so one of the things that happened during that time and is common practice is having a carcass pile, dumping your dead cows in the corner of your pasture. And the first depredation of livestock in Oregon were some sheep in the Keating Valley near Baker City. And those wolves were drawn in by a 2-acre carcass pit where wolves are also scavengers. They find bone piles and they use them to mark territory. It doesn't take long of eating on rotting old cows or sheep that you see those nice, young, juicy ones and you decide you want to try one. So one of the simplest things people can do is clean up those carcass pits. And the other one of the other simplest is just simply having a human presence. If you turn your cows loose on public lands for 4 months and don't check on them, you're going to lose livestock. And that's the thing. They're lost to all sorts of different causes, injuries, theft, disease, simply wandering off. Lots of livestock go missing. So the question is, you know, do we want to solve the problem the best way or the most cathartic way and the simplest way, which is shooting wolves? And I think in the 21st century, if your business model requires killing an endangered species, you've got a flawed business model for the 21st century.
Well, it sounds to me like you're talking about having more hands-on ranching. The two things you're describing, the behavior that needs to be changed. I didn't know about the carcass pits, but it sounds like really lazy ranching to just throw your dead animals in a pit on the edge of your property.
Well, you said it.
I know. I don't have to live next to your neighbors.
Right. Well, and there are a lot of really responsible ranchers. There's a lot of folks, again, who are welcoming wolves back. They may not want to put themselves out there and say, you know, we support wolf recovery and we love Oregon Wild. But I can tell you a lot of my neighbors who ranch, and we have cows on our property, that are thrilled to have wolves back. It's just, you know, maybe not what you want to speak out on. And it might be sort of like being a conservative in Portland, you may not put that bumper sticker on your truck, you know, because, or I guess out here it'd be a Prius.
Actually, I think I did see a Prius with a Ben car, Isn't it Carson?
But yeah, I think. But yeah, the reality is there's a lot that people can do, and we're continuing. People are trying new things. So yeah, you know, if you just turn your cows loose and expect them to come back, but any animal husbandry, I think it's important to be responsible. And people are seeing that by doing the things to reduce conflict with wolves, by checking your livestock more often in places where people really are implementing this earnestly, they're having less losses to other things. If your cow gets injured, you know it, rather than having it be taken down by a cougar or simply die a slow, painful death.
And you need less of those carcass pits if you're taking care of your animals in a timely fashion.
That's true.
I mean, it does seem to me that there's, okay, this is my judgment, I guess, from living on the west side of the Cascades, but there are ranchers who are really fully engaged with the husbandry and with just and taking care of the land, and it means being out on your land and just walking, riding, whatever, driving your land so that you really know what's going on there. And there's others who seem to have a much more laissez-faire attitude towards it, which is it seems to me more of an old school, maybe a mid-school approach. Because I have a feeling that in the early days people were maybe more engaged, and there's somewhere in the long line of all that BLM land that they started to be able to graze on, that they started taking more stuff for granted, including the safety of their livestock if they're not out monitoring.
Well, and again, I think, you know, you do have, people have a responsibility. And I think that's a metaphor I hear frequently is, you know, if somebody to wolves, if somebody was robbing your store, and you were told you couldn't do anything about it, how would you feel? Well, if you're leaving your door open all night and leaving the jewelry case unlocked, well, then, you know, that's, there's some responsibility there as well. And again, I think there are really legitimate concerns. It's just a question of, you know, are we just going to shoot wildlife anytime that there's a problem because that's easy? And likewise with wolves, we have a population in the entire state of Oregon of 81 wolves, known wolves. So even if you double that number, there's still not a lot of wolves in the state. We can have a different conversation when we have a recovered population. The reality is, though, we had folks in the Oregon Cattlemen's Association on radio shows calling for wolf hunts when there were less than 10 wolves in the state. And that was the idea of Oregon's wolf plan and the management. In a broad brush is that as the population is low, we're going to prioritize conservation, and we're going to prioritize education, and we're going to prioritize non-lethal conflict prevention. As the population grows, some of those restrictions can ease. And I'm not excited for the day of wolf recreational trophy hunting for wolves, as we've seen in other states. But it certainly makes sense, though, that as the population increases, you can have a different conversation. We have 81 known wolves in the entire state of Oregon, occupying 12% of the habitat that's available for them, which has already diminished from what it used to be. So, you know, we're at a place where we can celebrate how far we've come, but what's really concerning by recent decisions by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, some of the bills that are in the legislature that seem to come every single year, is that it looks like some people are ready to declare mission accomplished and turn the page back to old school, you know, killing any animal that we find inconvenient. And that, I don't think, honors what Oregon has become and strives to be as a state that values its conservation ethic.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Rob Clavins, who's the Northeast Oregon Field Organizer for Oregon Wild, and Stephanie Taylor, who's Oregon Wild's Wolf Organizer. We're talking about the comeback of wolves to the state of Oregon and some of the challenges that comeback is facing. Well, let's talk about some of the legislation that's being proposed for the coming session and what your concerns are and what you're planning to do about it.
Well, what we've seen is, you know, every year there's legislation to undermine the wolf plan to make killing wolves easier. And that started the moment that wolves came back into the state of Oregon. And every year we have to fight it. Every year we're outgunned. And knock on wood, most of the time we've been successful in defeating those bills. The legislative session this year is going to get underway in a couple of weeks here. And we've already seen the first wolf bill, which is for the legislature to delist wolves. And the reality is, on the one hand, it's a silly bill. Whether we like it or not, wolves are currently delisted from the State Endangered Species Act. This bill would simply make it legislatively so, and would also prevent wolves from being relisted except under very specific circumstances. What is troubling about that is the state created the Endangered Species Act. The legislature created the Endangered Species Act because they didn't want to manage on a species by species basis. And the precedent there that if there's an inconvenient animal, the legislature can step in on behalf of the mining industry because some salamander, you know, endangered salamander gets in the way. Or, you know, if you can do this to one of the most charismatic, one of the most endangered, one of the most persecuted animals in the state of Oregon, what's going to prevent that from, you know, from delisting delisting salmon that get in the way of a dam project? So it really is a troubling precedent. And the reality is it's simply unnecessary. We've asked for a legal review of the wolf delisting. We believe that the state violated the law. You know, the public didn't support delisting of wolves. Over 96% of over 10,000 public comments were in favor of protecting wolves. The scientific community weighed in. There were scathing critiques from world-renowned scientists that the state essentially simply ignored. And they also violated the law in delisting wolves. So we've asked for a legal review, but there's no injunction. Again, whether we like it or not, wolves are off the state endangered species list. So this bill is simply, it's totally unnecessary.
Well, is there a possibility that with your lawsuit that there will there will be an injunction down the line and that perhaps wolves will be relisted?
We have not asked for an injunction. We've asked for a judge to say whether it was legal or not. We believe, to be clear, that if the state were to consider the best available science, they would come to a different conclusion. And there were over a dozen scientists from around the world. And just one of the quotes is, it's untenable to think that being extirpated from nearly 90% of current range would qualify the species for delisting. It is my expert opinion that the existing analysis is fundamentally flawed and does not provide an adequate assessment of Oregon wolf population. And that's a letter signed by a number of world-renowned scientists. But the state simply ignored that. And that's what's really troubling, is we wanted to see the state follow a process. The wolf plan called for considering whether or not wolves should stay on the endangered species list or not at this time. And so we didn't object to the state asking the question, should they be or not? But when they ignore the science, when they ignore the public and simply delist wolves because for political expediency, that's when we have a much bigger problem.
So you have the lawsuit filed. So where are you going to be going from here?
Well, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, I guess, depending on your perspective, but the justice system works very slowly, and it's going to be a long time before a judge rules. Most of the management is informed by a wolf plan that is still in place. Unfortunately, in their rush to delist wolves, the state ignored a legal obligation to review the wolf plan. So some of the parts of it are outdated and are ready for review, which the state will undertake this year. So that's something that we'll be certainly involved in. But we're a long way from any sort of decision. So, again, the legislation to pile on for legislators, politicians to substitute their judgment is really problematic. We have a system of checks and balances that says if you think that the state violated the law, you can ask for a legal review of that. And that's what we've done.
Well, in the meantime, do you think that more wolves are going to be killed because of the delisting?
We'll see. I'm more concerned, again, that wolf plan goes in phases, and we've gone to a new phase, and the state ignored their obligation to review the plan prior to this time. And there was a tremendous amount of ambiguity. There's some very good things in there that just say we will prioritize conservation, but what does that mean? We will only kill wolves that are chronically depredating. But chronic depredation means any two depredations over, which is to say wolves killing livestock, over any time period, so over any geographical area. So that's not what's intended by it. So there's a lot of ambiguity in the plan that if the state decides to honor what the intent was, it shouldn't be slaughter of wolves. But there's enough ambiguity in there that they could also give in to political pressure to kill wolves. We've been here before, and we saw wolves killed by the state. So we're going to continue to work hard. And I think it's really important for the public who does value native wildlife to speak up. And so talk to your state representative and tell them you value native wildlife. When you get emails from Oregon Wild, sign up to our email list. Maybe you want to talk about some of the
other things. Yeah, because that's how this show started. I got an email from you, Stephanie, about the delisting. So how can people get involved?
Well, in addition to the litigation that Oregon Wild and other groups have filed, we also coordinate a wildlife activist program. called The Wild Ones, and we train people who care about wildlife how to advocate for wildlife using their voice. And we have been able to pack Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife public meetings with people trained and prepared to testify for wolves. We have gotten letters to the editor and op-eds published, and we have a few upcoming events happening soon.
And there's one you wanted to talk about?
Sure, yeah. We are hosting a film screening tomorrow night at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 o'clock. It's called Medicine of the Wolf, and it's a really powerful film about someone who used to shoot wildlife as a job, who is now shooting them with a camera, and is a renowned wildlife photographer for National Geographic, and his journey to become someone who is now spiritually connected to wildlife and wolves. This takes place in Minnesota, where they have been delisted and relisted, and there's been wolf hunts, and just his experience going through that.
Well, I'm thinking when you talked about wolf hunts, I'm thinking about what goes on in British Columbia, where there's quite a thriving, compared to the lower 48, there's a thriving wolf population along, particularly in the coast of British Columbia. And there's also these tour boats that go around with trophy hunters, and they shoot wolves. And that seems to be a problem when you have a relatively abundant population, that there's still a belief that you can, I guess there's nothing like going out and killing a wolf. I guess that's one of the things that Sarah Palin was really proud of.
Yeah, well, you won't be surprised to hear I would not take much pleasure in shooting a wild dog and putting it up on my wall. That said, you know, I think, again, it kind of comes down to a numbers thing, which is, you know, we have 81 wolves in the state. So it's a lot where it's really premature to be talking about a wolf hunt at all.
You have them, though. That's the thing that really gets me, because you don't eat wolf.
Right. Well, and again, I think the big thing is there are a lot of unintended consequences. You know, it comes down to if you think just killing 10% of the population reduces the population by 10%, so that means there's 10% more elk and you like to shoot elk, then you should shoot a wolf. There's certainly some ethical questions there, but simply it also doesn't work that way scientifically. That's just not the way it works. And with the population we have cautionary tales. All of the wolves that have been genetically tested in Oregon are related to the small number of wolves that were reintroduced into central Idaho. They're all related to each other. And there was a population of Mexican gray wolves in the Southwest that was about this population size, 50s and 60s. And because of aggressive management, that population really stalled out. They're recovering again now.
Aggressive management, meaning they killed them.
Right. And so the question is, you know, what kind of Oregon do we want to have? You know, do we want to have this token persecuted population of wolves that, you know, they're allowed to live in the Eagle Cap Wilderness, and as soon as they step foot across it, they can get shot. Or as soon as they look the wrong way at a cow, they get shot. There was legislation from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association a few years ago that said a wolf could be shot, any wolf that's seen molesting, chasing, threatening livestock. If you think every wolf is a threat, every wolf is threatening livestock, so you can kill it. So do we want to have healthy, abundant populations of native wildlife, or do we just want to have sort of token populations here or there? And I think, you know, for the last 60 years, you couldn't have heard wolves howling in the wilderness. You couldn't have seen a wolf track. And I can tell you, you know, when I get to go out, and I'm lucky enough to live in the shadow of the Eagle Cap Mountains, and when I can go into that wilderness and follow the tracks of a wolf and hope that I might be able to hear a howl, what a rich experience that is. And I think that's something I want to be able to pass on to future generations. So we certainly have challenges, and it's important that we address legitimate concerns. But simply turning back the page to the 1860s, where we could just shoot any animal that we didn't like, that doesn't make sense in the 21st century.
Well, Rob and Stephanie, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Locus Focus. And it's been real interesting hearing about this. And let's stay in touch, because I'd like to, as the legislation goes through its wheels, maybe we can touch base again in the later spring and see what's happening. So we've been talking this morning with Rob Clavins, who's the Northeast Oregon Field Organizer for Oregon Wild, and Stephanie Taylor, Oregon Wild Wolf Organizer. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And before we depart, we're going to be switching gears in a few minutes and spending the rest of the afternoon, morning and afternoon, celebrating Martin Luther King Day with a live feed. and special programming throughout the afternoon. But before that, I just want to let you know a couple events that are coming up. Tomorrow at Holiday Park at noon, there's going to be a rally in support of Malheur and Public Lands in Portland. The rallies are going to be in Portland, Eugene, Bend, and beyond. And so the one in Portland is at Holiday Park near Lloyd Center, 911 Northeast 11th. Starts at noon. There's also one at Riverfront Plaza in downtown Bend, one in Eugene at the Old Federal Building, and in LeGrand, there's a pro-public lands potluck, and Hood River and Corvallis to stay to be decided, so I don't have information about that. But if you go to the Audubon Society website, which is audubonportland.org, there's more information about that. And next week on my show, I'll be having Bob Salinger from Portland Audubon on and Aaron Robertson from Oregon Wild, and we'll be talking about the standoff in Malheur and what that's all about. Also want to let you know that on Thursday, the Multnomah County commissioners are going to be hearing testimony about or deciding about supporting vocal opposition to the oil terminal being proposed in Vancouver by Tesoro Savage, and that's at 9:30 at the Multnomah County building. If you missed this, you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show today, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell, and stay tuned for the Martin Luther King Day celebration coming up at 11.
KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill two vacancies on the Board of Directors. The Board will elect the new directors at the February Board meeting. Are you interested in nonprofit governance and in helping to shape the future of your community radio station? Do you have 10 to 15 hours per month to support KBOO? Then this may be just the right opportunity for you. The application and instructions are posted on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and paper copies are available at the station. In order to be eligible to fill one of these two vacant seats on the KBOO Board of Directors, you must be a KBOO member and you must submit a complete application by either emailing the document at kboocommunity@gmail.com, or by mailing or dropping off the completed documents to the station to the attention of Timothy Welp, KBOO Community Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please send in your application by 5 p.m., February 15, 2016. If you have any questions, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com. Thank you for your support of Community Radio.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With